Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
There's a question that's been bugging me for a while now.
How many flies have ever existed?
Crowd Science, the podcast with a thirst for knowledge.
Why do we daydream?
Why is the sea salty?
We'll go and try and speak to some people and find out.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, a campaign to create books and libraries where there are none in Liberia. And
there's blood, there's broken bones, there's smashed jaws, ripped faces, ripped tendons. It's everything and more. And the fact that it encompasses a wide variety of different kind of combat styles is what makes it so appealing to a lot of people.
What is behind the growing appeal of mixed martial arts on the continent? It's Wednesday, the 21st of August. First, we go to Lebanon. The war in Gaza is in the headlines every day. For many, it's happening on TV and online. But the conflict, which began on the 7th of October, when the Palestinian militant group Hamas attacked Israel, might be spreading to Lebanon. Because another group, Hezbollah, which is based in southern Lebanon, has also been involved in conflict with Israel from across the border. Lebanese residents and citizens are fearful that full-scale war will break out. Almost a quarter of a million domestic workers, many of them African women, are especially worried, as my colleague Priyanka Sipi has been finding out.
The situation right now is very difficult for everyone in Lebanon. We saw a couple of weeks ago that many countries like the UK, like the USA, France and Australia were calling their nationals back, encouraging them to leave the country because of this fear of a regional war breaking out. But leaving Lebanon for some is easy, and for others it can be very difficult. Amnesty International estimate around 250,000 domestic workers, with a large percentage of them coming from Africa and Asia.
You've spoken directly to some of the workers. What kinds of things did they tell you?
So we've been speaking to a few domestic workers in Beirut at the moment, all who are from Kenya, and they've been living there for the past year. Over the past few weeks, they've said they've essentially been living in fear. They've been hearing the sounds of Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon, but obviously they're very worried that it might come closer to Beirut. We spoke to one woman called Yulita, and this is what she told us.
There was a lot of sounds, and we are being told it's not bombs, but it's a sound barrier. But it's so scary. I really want to go back home, but we have challenges going back home. Most of our employers are holding our passports. You cannot just leave even if you have the passport, because you need an exit visa.
That sound at the beginning was quite scary. What was it?
So that was the Israeli warplanes flying low over the city that created the sonic boom.
Right.
And Yulita told us that when she went to her employer with concerns, they told her, don't worry, it's just breaking the sound barrier. It's not a bomb. But obviously, she said that created a lot of tension for her. And we also spoke to her auntie in Kenya, and she told us that Yulita doesn't have the money to be able to come back home. They're really relying on the Kenyan government to be able to help.
What have the countries where these women come from been saying about their nationals in Lebanon? Because nationals from other countries have been able to leave. And it's a perennial problem for women from African countries that they often find themselves in trouble in Lebanon. It's not the first time we're reporting on this.
Definitely. And we've spoken to the Kenyan government. They're one of the only African governments to put out a statement about this, and they have encouraged their nationals in Lebanon to register with them if they want and wish to be evacuated. So we spoke to Rosalind Njogu, who's the Principal Secretary for Diaspora Affairs in Kenya, and she told us about 1,500 Kenyans have registered so far out of 26,000 who are living there. So that's still a huge number of people that haven't registered for evacuation. So they are still working to get this communication out there to people that are concerned. And they have plans in place and can offer emergency flights should the situation come to that. But right now, they are not. They're advising people to move to a safer place if they can. We also spoke to the Ethiopian government. We spoke to Nibuyu Tedla, who's the government spokesperson for Ethiopia. He estimates there are over 100,000 Ethiopians in Lebanon, the majority of who are domestic workers. And this is what he told us.
So far, we have made a decision to stop the travel of our domestic workers to Lebanon. We are also trying to prepare a contingency plan to bring back those whose travel document has been taken away from them by their employees.
So there are also African domestic workers from Ghana, from Sierra Leone, from many countries in East Africa. And it's unsure at the moment what evacuation plans their governments have in place. But we do know whatever evacuation plans may exist, domestic workers could still face challenges to leave, having money for the flight, having their passport, having their exit visa. So it's a very worrying time for them right now.
The BBC's Priyanka Sippy. Now let's take a closer look at the kafala system, which restricts the rights of domestic workers, making it difficult for people like Yulita to leave. Ramzi Kais is a researcher at Human Rights Watch in Beirut. We spoke about the kafala system, but I asked him first what the mood was like in Lebanon.
Domestic workers in Lebanon are excluded from the labor law protections. This includes minimum wage protections, limits on working hours, overtime pay, freedom of movement or changing employers. So the status of migrant domestic workers in Lebanon is governed or regulated by a series of very restrictive laws and regulations that's called the kafala system or the sponsorship system. This system essentially ties the presence of a migrant worker in the country or their legal residency to their employer. So if you're a migrant domestic worker in Lebanon, you cannot leave or change your employer without their permission or their consent. If you do so, you could be subject to, you know, losing your legal residency, to detention, to deportation. So essentially, you are placed at a very high risk of exploitation and abuse. And other, you know, Lebanese rights groups have documented how the system has enabled or led to other violations, which include forced labor, human trafficking, and others.
The sexual assault as well.
What's worth noting here as well is that, you know, we found that the Lebanese judiciary has failed to hold employers or other perpetrators accountable for abuses against migrant domestic workers, and that often, you know, security agencies don't adequately investigate claims of violence or abuse. So really, migrant domestic workers are left without a realistic or true legal recourse that they could pursue if they are subjected to violations or abuse in the country.
So there's no political will to change these conditions and to make the lives of domestic workers better. But how does this affect domestic workers in the event of, you know, a crisis like this one? Should people need to evacuate? Are they protected at least by the people that they work for, or are they left to their own devices?
In light of the fact that there are no protections enshrined in the law, then I think domestic workers, we would suspect, are just subject to the whims of their employers. And this is keeping in mind that often some of the, you know, abuses that migrant domestic workers face is that the fact that they're not paid on time, often for months, and in some cases been documented for years. Something that we saw during the early years of the crisis, the economic crisis, is that often hundreds of migrant workers were left outside their embassies by their employers, sometimes without their belongings, without their passports, unable to leave back to their country. So if a domestic worker is left to their own whims in the country, it can be a very, very difficult process in order just to secure repatriation back to their countries if that support is not provided by the embassies, by other countries, or by their employers.
Has the kafala system actually been tested in terms of international law? Has there been a case brought to determine whether it's legal or illegal under international law?
I'm not sure about that, at least at the Lebanese level. I'm sure, you know, there may be cases in other countries. There have been efforts to abolish the system or at least to limit the violations that it enables, and those faced great backlash or pressure from the syndicate of recruitment agencies as Lebanon, which then, you know, pushed for certain protections that were afforded to be removed.
That's Ramzi Kais, Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch. Liberia is Africa's oldest republic. It has a complex history, as you can imagine, but it has had its glory days. In more recent times, though, there have been civil wars, the Ebola epidemic, and patchy leadership, to say the least. Coming out of all those challenges is a resilience and a determination to establish a different trajectory for the country. Writers are doing their bit in this, determined to tell new stories. But they face an uphill battle. As Liberia's literary scene is being rebuilt, the impact of the civil war on education and infrastructure has created a vacuum in the cultural landscape, with emerging writers lacking a fundamental building block for literary growth: bookshops. Jeremy Teddy Khan is a young Liberian poet who is determined to change this. He is part of a growing group of writers working to create libraries and bookshops. But we began our conversation with his personal experiences as a Liberian reader and writer. So I'm going to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about how you started the journey of becoming a writer. What made you decide that this is what you wanted to do with your life?
Initially, I was supposed to enter law school right after high school. So during my final year of my high school, I was introduced to poetry, my English instructor, and I just fell in love with it and decided, like, oh, law school is not for me. I should do this. I should get into writing and tell my story. I think that was the most important thing. That's what drove me into writing, telling my story and the story of every other Liberian.
And why did you think that it was important to tell your story and the story of Liberians?
I think in the last 20 to 30 years, there have been a huge silence in Liberia. Nothing was coming out of Liberia in terms of literature. So there was somebody that needed to do that, to tell the story of Liberia, what we have been through. And I think that's what drove me into being really serious about doing it.
Did you say that you thought that people were not writing about Liberia and telling the story of Liberia in the last 30 years?
People are writing, but at the end of the war, there was a huge silence and there was nothing coming out of Liberia because there was a fighter, because in Liberia we don't have publishing entity, and so there's lack of opportunity for Liberian to tell a story. There are people who have stories to be told, but there's no opportunity, there's no resources.
I find that strange, though, because there are lots of writers from Liberia that have been writing about Liberia. Wayetu, I can name lots of
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But the thing is, it's like this. So most of these Liberian writers you see, they are doing well. They all got their voices outside of Liberia. They were not in Liberia when they found their voices. So
right, I see the difference you're making. Okay, so these are people that were elsewhere, but you were in Liberia as a child experiencing the war. You were also there during the Ebola crisis and all of that.
Yeah.
So tell me, how did that experience shape your desire to become a writer?
I think experiencing the war and also the Ebola crisis have placed Liberia in a very difficult situation, because most of we were really young when we experienced the war, and also coming out to experience Ebola, we have a really traumatic childhood. So I feel like in order for us to heal from this thing, we needed to express ourselves, we needed to tell our story. Telling our story by means of writing is another form of healing. So
did you have lots of books around you that you could escape into when you were a child, when you were growing up?
No, I cannot say that, because having books at home was something that was really uncommon.
So where did you come across books? Because they say to be a writer, you have to be a reader. In fact, that's where writing starts. It's from reading other books.
So most of the book that we read in was book that was prescribed by the Ministry of Education first. And most of them are books from Nigeria and from Ghana. And they are commonly found in Liberia, but not in Boston, but on the sidewalk. And some of us just read that book just for the purpose of school, not to enjoy all the pleasure of reading. It was just for getting a passing mark in school, not for enjoyment or for the pleasure of reading.
So where did that come from for you then?
The sidewalk. Not from bookstore, but usually from sidewalk. There are people that are selling books on the sidewalk in the street of Moravia.
But those are usually educational books, aren't they? They're usually sort of textbooks and so on. They're not very often novels. So did you look for novels and poetry books among them?
Yeah, sure. And they was all on the sidewalk, and there are not many. In Liberia, the most common book you find is Things for a Bat by Chimamanda Achebe. That's the most common book you find in Liberia. So
Things Fall Apart.
Yeah.
Right. And so you read that, and did that entice you into writing, or was it something else?
No, there was a Liberian writer named Batimo that I read. I think that's what encouraged me to get into writing.
There aren't bookshops in Liberia at the moment. There aren't libraries. How do you think that affects a young writer like you?
For me, being a young writer and coming to face the situation of not having a bookshop, a library is... it's going to affect me as a writer, because me being a writer, I have to read and I have to read more, and not having these things, it provides no room for improvement and having to expand my craft, because the more you read, the more you get to learn new things for other writers. And
it's an interesting form, poetry, and it's even more niche than being a novelist, in the sense of when your parents ask you, so what are you going to do? You were meant to be a lawyer. Now you're going to be a writer, and not just a writer, you're going to be a poet. What did they say? Because there is an attitude amongst very many parents, not just Liberian parents, and it was actually expressed by Janetta Connor, another writer living in Liberia, and she says there's an attitude that literature won't carry you far. Is that an attitude that you came across?
that's new, because when I started writing, my parents wasn't really, really supportive of what I'm doing, like giving away the dream of being a lawyer for them and getting into writing. Even when I got into the Iron Writer workshop, my father wasn't really sure like I should pursue it, but this is what I wanted. The moment I got into this opportunity, I knew that this is what I should do. As the initial state, they wasn't really, really supportive, but I thought it's good, my mother, she understood that this is what I love, this is what I have passion for, and eventually they begin to support me.
I know that you're doing it for the love of it, but you also want to expand the experience of other Liberian writers. So there's a significant push, and you're one of the people behind this, to establish a bookshop in Liberia. Tell us about it.
For now, we are not trying to get a bookshop in Liberia, because we are trying to get a library back in Liberia, in St. John Morufia. So with some Liberian who are in the state, I mean, we are like getting more book buyings, some news book, secondhand book from bookshop and public library, that will be able to send them back to Liberia in the coming years, and set up a library so that other Liberian writer or other young Liberian will have the opportunity to read and just have book around them.
Getting books to Liberians initiative. Is it underway? Is it actually happening as we speak? And there are books going into Liberia from people in the diaspora?
It's not for people in the diaspora. It's just from a few Liberians who are in the U.S. And so we are basically collecting books from friends, buying books also from secondhand bookshop. So we are kind of stocking them. But we have like really, really enough, then we'll have them transported to Liberia.
So let's talk about the 5 books that you think and you wish were in bookshops that you would love every Liberian to read. And actually, I would say not just Liberians, but anybody. So essentially, your 5 favorite books.
I think So Long a Letter by Mariam Abba is a really important book for Liberian, especially Liberian women. And Breaking the Silence is an anthology that was published by a Liberian famous poet, Patricia J. Wesley. She's still in the U.S. And it's an anthology that goes back all the way to the founding of Liberia. So it's one of the books that I think most Liberians should read. And always, She'll Be King by Waita Moore is a really important historical book that most Liberians should read. And The Trial by Friend Kafka is an important book too for me. And lastly, Everything Good to Come by Sefi Atta is another amazing book too. So for now, these are my favorite 5 books.
I find Kafka very scary to write because it's so much like life. It's a lot like dealing with the bureaucracy. It's just too much. Thank you very much for your favorites. And I'm interested to see that we share some favorites there. Thank you so much. This has been really interesting. I love to talk about books. I love books.
Yeah.
I've got more books than anything else. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Jeremy Teddy Khan, a young Liberian poet, currently an MFA candidate at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the United States. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
CrowdScience takes your questions about life, Earth, and the universe, and goes in search of answers.
I've become a guinea pig.
Can I confirm that you can't see anything?
I think it might be the first time I've touched a snake.
If it's interesting, we investigate.
We have the technology and the know-how to do it.
Whoa! Okay, blinding light as you open that.
Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
I was just wondering what the science might be behind that.
This is like nothing I have ever experienced.
Very strange indeed.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I want to take you into a boxing ring now. But instead of the, shall we say, discipline of two fighters throwing quick jabs, uppercuts and hooks at each other, dancing away out of reach of punishing straights, you see two men going at it, choking, kicking and wrestling with each other. If you see that, you'd be looking at a mixed martial arts fight. Maybe you knew that already, because the sport is growing at a tremendous rate on the continent. Audiences love it. Fighters love it too. And together, they're driving the sport to greater heights. In fact, in 2021, three African fighters held the Ultimate Fighting Championship titles in their respective weights at the same time. They were Cameroon's Francis Ngannou, Nigerian-born Kamaru Usman, and Israel Adesanya, also from Nigeria. Just last weekend, the world's biggest MMA organization, the UFC, held its first ever all-African title fight in Australia. We'll talk about that fight in a minute, but if you are one of those people who didn't know much about mixed martial arts, here's Nyasha Michelle with everything you need to know about it.
MMA stands for Mixed Martial Arts. It's a full-contact combat sport that allows a range of different fighting techniques. Oh. So you're going to see the fighters punch, like in boxing, but also kick, wrestle, and throw each other to the ground. Fighting can take place standing up, or it can continue with both fighters on the floor. Fighters are allowed to use chokeholds to force an opponent into submission and win the fight. Victory can also be won by knockout when one fighter is knocked unconscious. If there isn't a winner by any of these methods after a set number of rounds, then judges decide the winner. MMA fighters wear padded gloves with open fingers and fight barefooted. The ring for MMA is known as the octagon because it has eight sides. It has a fence around it, which is why it's also sometimes called cage fighting. There are different organizations which run MMA fights and award titles. The Ultimate Fighting Championship, or UFC, is the biggest and most well-known. Others include the Professional Fighters League, or PFL, and Bellator.
Now that you know what MMA is, let's take a look at why it's so popular on the continent. Babatunde Koiki is a Nigerian sports journalist who stayed up into the wee small hours of the morning to watch the UFC's All-Africa title fight in Australia between South Africa's Dricus du Plessis and Nigerian-born Israel Adesanya. Did you hear that Drake, the rapper, the Canadian rapper, was supposed to have put money on this fight? $500,000 or so.
He does it all the time. And I don't think he's ever won it once.
So he's like the kiss of death.
Oh, yeah. It's known colloquially as the curse of Drake. Whoever Drake backs ends up losing.
Oh, my goodness. Poor Drake. Well, I mean, he's got lots of opportunities to continue doing it, right? Because
he's got lots of money.
Yeah, but MMA is growing as well. So it's something that he's going to be able to spend some of that money on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going at a prodigious rate, if you ask me.
Okay. Well, tell me why.
Well, I mean, the interest. I don't know. There's something particularly primal about it. There's boxing, yeah? Everybody knows boxing. It's just two men going at it with their fists. But MMA offers so much more. There's grappling, there's jiu-jitsu, there's striking, there's kicking. It's a really primal form of combat that taps into the base instincts of humans, if you ask me. And it just pretty much excites them, man. I think that's what it's really all about.
So is MMA more like boxing or more like wrestling, which is very performative as well, actually? You know, like you're never sure whether they're really hitting each other, whether they're really choking each other, whether they're really pinning each other down, if there's any pain being caused in any way.
Oh, trust me, MMA is as real as it gets. There's blood, there's broken bones, there's smashed jaws, ripped faces, ripped tendons. it's everything and more. And the fact that it encompasses a wide variety of different kind of combat styles is what makes it so appealing to a lot of people.
Let's talk about the UFC's All-African title fight at the weekend. It sounds like it was a really big deal. Why is that?
It was a big deal simply because of the eternal rivalry between Nigeria and South Africa.
Well, that I'm a South African. You do know this, right?
So I'm not saying anything that you don't know. You know, there was so much riding on it. There's Afrobeats, Amapiano. There's the eternal rivalry between the Bafana Bafana and the Super Eagles of Nigeria. Look, Audrey, if two cockroaches were fighting, one from Nigeria, one from South Africa, people would be interested. It's that serious.
But I thought that this was more about the sport itself.
Yes, for the first time in UFC history, two Africans contested for the right to be king of a division. It never happened before. It was two Africans that were on the main stage for the first time in the history of the sport. But it now went a notch higher when Dricos du Plessis, who's the South African, who's current middleweight champion, he was doing interviews and arguing that Israel Adesanya, who was the previous champion, was not African enough. He claimed that he was the bona fide African.
And that's hilarious, right? That's hilarious coming from Dricus, given that he's a white South African.
Exactly. But he, you know, because of his Afrikaner background, he said he was born, raised in South Africa. He trains in South Africa. He lives in South Africa, eats South African food every day. He's more African than Israel Adesanya, whose parents migrated to New Zealand when he was 9. Now, there was a time when there were three Africans who held one version of the UFC title or the other. In the heavyweight, there was Francis Ngannou. In the middleweight, there was Israel Adesanya. And in the other weight division, right below Israel Adesanya, there was Kamaru Usman. And all three of them were parading themselves as the three kings, the three African kings. Now, Dricus du Plessis was arguing that they could not be three African kings because he was more African than them. He was born, raised, trained, and still lives in Africa, while the others now live in the diaspora. So it added a little bit of spice to this particular encounter.
Sounds like
both men had a face-off in the ring. Trash talking, exactly. Both men had a face-off in the ring. It just pretty much set the tone for what was a compelling fight.
Oh, was it a good fight, I was going to ask?
Oh, it was a brilliant fight. I thought both men gave it their all. They really went at it exactly as I expected to. Each punch was thrown with malice and venom. I thought up until the point where he was finishing, Israel Adesanya seemed to be edging it, but it was a really close contest. In the fourth round, Dricus du Plessis just found an extra gear. Adesanya just walked into an excellent left hook. Dricus du Plessis followed that up with three more fabulous rights, pulled his man down, climbed over him, got a red naked choke, and Adesanya had pretty much no choice but to submit or pass out.
Okay, so Israel Adesanya said that Africa won when the fight was over, the fight that he had lost. It seems to me that he didn't take Dricus's trash talking all that seriously. And in fact, he was recognizing the spirit of the game as something growing on the continent. Why is it doing so well in Africa?
Many reasons. One, because of the success of the likes of Israel Adesanya, Francis Ngannou, Kamaru Usman, and now Dricus du Plessis. Africans can see these are people like them, everyday people like them who came from nothing and who are now doing so much with just basically their hands and their feet. You know, they've literally taken their own destinies into their own hands. Then there's also the incredible, heartwarming story of a certain Themba Gorimbo. He's Zimbabwean, came from terrible poverty as well, made it to the UFC. He'd been sleeping in couches in his coach's office or in gyms. And the superstar Dwayne The Rock Johnson actually heard about the story and gifted him a house. So people can see that.
Now, let's talk about the money in the game. None of the big global MMA franchises have actually held a fight in Africa. The fight we're just talking about between Dricus and Israel was in Australia.
True.
When will that change and what can change it?
Well, I think it's an inevitability. It's a matter of when, not if, because of the growing popularity of the sport across the continent. Then there's also so many issues regarding facilities, how many arenas across the African continent can host something of that level that the promoters of the franchise would like it. Can the fans actually afford the tickets to come through to ensure that the spectacle is as good as they'd like it to be? Senegal has a fantastic new basketball arena. It's possible. Rwanda, too, also has their new BK Arena as well, which they use for the Basketball Africa League. It's possible there. South Africa, too, also has excellent venues as well. There's a new arena being built in Lagos now. I think it's a 12,000, 15,000 arena that was coming up in the next 2 years. That's a possible destination as well. North Africa, too, is also possible. But I can tell, as a matter of fact, the interest is high. In Senegal, there's the local wrestling circuit, which attracts thousands of people. In Nigeria, here, there's the Dambe boxing circuit, which is traditional boxing, which also attracts thousands of people as well. So it's a matter of time before it comes to Africa.
So how popular is MMA in Nigeria?
Oh, it's very popular. And the popularity actually went through the roof because of the success of the likes of Israel Adesanya and Kamaru Usman. Both of them identified with their roots, despite the fact that they live outside the continent. They come back, they met with the people, political figures. Kamaru Usman actually even invested in a local MMA franchise here in Nigeria. It's known as the African Knockout Series. That also incorporates fighters from across the continent as well. So it's growing. It's really growing. I've been to one event. It was packed, absolutely packed to the rafters. And I'm telling you, Audrey, it was men and women. It taps into the base instincts of humans, irrespective of sex.
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's the sports journalist Babatunde Koiki in Nigeria. Focus on Africa came together due to the efforts of Bella Hassan, Joseph Keane, Rob Wilson and Nyasha Michelle here in London. Blessing Aderogba and Toda Opeyemi stepped up from Lagos. Paul Bachibinga was our senior producer. Nick Randell was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Crowd Science takes your questions about life, Earth and the universe and goes in search of answers.
I've become a guinea pig.
Can I confirm that you can't see anything?
I think it might be the first time I've touched a snake.
If it's interesting, we investigate.
We have the technology and the know-how to do it.
Whoa! Okay, blinding light as you open that.
Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
I was just wondering what the science might be behind that.
This is like nothing I have ever experienced.
Very strange indeed.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.